This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk. The Rugby World Cup from The Times with Mark Suster.
We'll be with you every week with the latest from the tournament, looking at the prospects for the home nations and the other big guns, of course, and reviewing all the action on and off the field.
Find it at thetimes.co.uk or in iTunes.
Audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, buglers, and we're back. 3 weeks away, but the world still in need of satirising. So we are back with issue 167 of The Bugle, the world's leading transatlantic satirico-comedy cast, with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in London, the city where Angela's fear to tread. And in New York City, it's Bertie Box Office himself, the matador of mirth, John El Pimientito Flagrante Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, buglers. We are back after a slightly prolonged break. We were supposed to be away for 2 weeks. We had to be away for three, as I had to go to L.A. last week to attend the Emmys, which it turns out does not get any less weird the number of times you go. I won an award for writing on The Daily Show. When I went backstage to pick up my trophy, Martin Scorsese walked past me, Andy, and I emitted a sound that I did not think was inside my body. But it turns out it's just been laying low for 34 years, just waiting for the perfect opportunity to come out. And it turns out that opportunity was wearing big glasses and directed some of my favourite films of all time. It's hard to describe the noise that came out, Andy. It was like if I was a Victorian lady who had just seen a mouse, but I was also a 50-year-old man who just accidentally opened a kitchen drawer onto his own balls. He walked past, and I basically made this sound.
And how did the big score hit back?
Well, I think he probably hears that noise quite a lot. Yeah. As he walks around the world. So, yeah, he took it in his stride.
Has he cast you in a film on the back of that or not?
Well, I don't think on the back of that. On the back of the fact that the Smurfs is currently $450 million worldwide, Andy. You don't need a man to make a strange noise to hear that. Well, you do, but it has to come out of a cartoon blue man.
The worst
huge
kind.
Success!
Commercial. Let's not omit the word commercial from that sentence, John.
Also, Andy, I stayed at an amazing place. A couple of weeks ago, I was doing a gig in Missouri, the University of Missouri. And there was a local hotel which was based entirely around the theme of English authors, which is quite a bold decision, because I'll tell you where there is no demand for that. England. So why the there is in rural Missouri is completely beyond me. Each room was themed around a different author. So as I walked down the corridor, and you saw like Shakespeare, Shelley, Byron, and then I walked past this door towards the end of the corridor that just said James Bond. And it's clear that they ran out of English authors a lot quicker than they thought they did. Oh shit, we better do a James Bond room. Not Ian Fleming, James Bond.
Well, his autobiography is very good. So this is... I've done absolutely nothing interesting for weeks. Anyway, so... This is Bugle 167 for the week beginning Monday, the 26th of September, 2011, meaning it's my parents' 41st wedding anniversary.
Oh!
That is the land anniversary, apparently.
What?
Yep. There's the...
Land?
Land. That is the land anniversary.
Oh, that's great.
So I think they just threw mud at each other over breakfast. If they make it as far as their 42nd anniversary, it'll be the improved real estate anniversary. And then it might start getting tricky for my father in 5 years, their 46th, the original poetry tribute anniversary. I'm not sure
that's romantic.
I don't know if he's got that club in his bag, John. But... But also, these are new mid-20th century anniversaries introduced in America to go with the more traditional wood, tin, china, silver, whatever. Gold, diamond, all that junk. But they've brought in new ones. And also, just over a week ago, it was my own 7th wedding anniversary. John, hard to believe it is 7 years since you threw those incredible shapes on that dance floor in Lincoln.
I sure did. Haven't thrown a single shape since.
Now, the traditional anniversary for the 7th wedding anniversary, that's the wood anniversary, but under the modern system, it is the desk sets anniversary. So, you know, I bought my wife the finest desk set that money can buy.
Well, you know how to please a lady.
Well, you know, when you've got this 7th year itch coming on, you've got to get your lady a good desk set, otherwise things will get out of control. And, of course, next year, the 8th wedding anniversary, that's the swearing anniversary. So, that's right,
that
my hitting
zone. That is made for you, Andy.
Yeah. We've now done as many bugles as body doubles used by Paul Newman in the filming of the egg-eating scene in Cool Hand Luke before he finally managed to get on to eat all the eggs without dying. Also as many bugles as times David Cameron has stood in front of a mirror pretending to be Bruce Lee in case he ever meets Colonel Gaddafi face-to-face and has to take him down for the cameras. And also, this is the penultimate bugle that could be used as a three-dart checkout. There's only 170 left after this.
Wow.
That really puts into context how long we've been doing this podcast now.
God, it sure does. Yeah. That was the only way to do it. The only way to do it is through dart checkouts, Andy. Yeah.
So, tough times for buglers and dart fans. In the bin, as always, a section of the Bugle is going straight in the bin. This week, an exclusive supplement to mark the return of the hit Emmy Award-winning early 20th century costume drama Downton Abbey. Now, did you meet the Downton Abbey crew at the Emmys, John?
No, but I did see the weirdest juxtaposition on stage that whole night was Julian Fellowes, the writer of Downton Abbey, standing next to the cast of Entourage, and it was clear that neither side really understood what the other one was doing with their face.
I prefer to think of Julian Fellowes as the host of the rightly short-lived BBC Three comedy panel show, Never Mind the Full Stops, a panel show entirely based on punctuation and grammar.
How did that not work? That had mainstream success all over it.
Why did Fellows not get the Emmy for that? And yet he does get it for Downton. Is Downton Abbey big in America, John?
I definitely don't care.
Anyway, so here's our exclusive supplements with spoilers on the second series. With war raging across Europe, can Lord Grantham complete the Times crossword and point at a tree before it's too late? Will the scandal of the slightly over-toasted toast ever be satisfactorily resolved? Will Bates ever recover from having a sip of water? Will old Mrs. Crawley and the octogenarian Dowager Countess ever get it on? Will Butler Carson admit to dipping his trongler in the soup just to see what it was like? Will Lady Fortuna recover from her embarrassing flatulence in front of Lord Scrifant? And what was Assistant Subvalet Painforth going on about when he started screaming about tearing the hearts out of virgins and sacrificing them to Beelzebub? Plus, how will the family react to the shocking discovery that Lady Ethel has a vagina? All coming up in Series 2 of the unmissable Downton Abbey.
Oh, such class-based drama, Andy. Top story this week, Italy our potato is no good. Andy,
are you auditioning for a pasta advert, John?
No, it's just I saw Scorsese. I want to show him that I can do Italian. It seems that Italy is about to join the list of countries who, economically speaking, are in a volcano of pain. They are the latest country to have their credit rating cut by Standard & Poor's, who lowered it from A+ to A. And that might not sound bad, A+ to, you know, still A, but it really is the equivalent of having a financial testicle lopped off with a sole remaining testicle now hanging and swinging around nervously and looking extremely vulnerable.
We've all been there.
Standard & Poor's explained the decision by citing Italy's weak growth and criticising Rome's response to the debt crisis so far, stating that its political uncertainty could hamper its recovery in the future. In response to that, Prime Minister, bugle favourite and career criminal Silvio Berlusconi said the move was influenced by, and I quote, political considerations. And yes, that is true, Silvio. One of those key reasons being that you are in Italian politics, Berlusconi. You complete horn dog.
So that's right, Silvio Berlusconi, the man who puts the dick into predictable, the prick into what a prick, and the cock into absolutely anything that moves, and probably a fair few things that don't move as well. He's been rolling back the year, Sean. He has been doling out some absolutely vintage Berlusconi as his nation's economy has gone absolutely more tits up than the teenage girls that frequent his boudoir. He apparently has been recorded in wiretapped conversations claiming that he had 11 women queuing outside his bedroom door, but had only managed to do 8 of them. Now, that's not necessarily the kind of language that you want from your Prime Minister. I mean, we've been there, of course, in Neville Chamberlain's wilder days before the war, but only 8 out of 11. That's rare restraint on the part of Berlusconi. He, of course, was born, sadly, 2,000 years too late to be vaguely acceptable. He also quipped that he spent so much time chasing tail that he was only able to be Prime Minister, quotes, in his spare time. And presumably Italy as a nation was thanking whatever gods it currently believes in for that. Just imagine the damage he could have done if he was concentrating on the job in hand, as opposed to, never mind, it's not that kind of show. Family show. It's a family show.
It's not so much the details exactly as when this is happening. Italy has Europe's second largest debt level, and that cost is climbing as lenders to Italy have become very nervous about its ability to repay loans. Basically, if you lent any money to Italy recently, don't be surprised if when you turn up at Italy's house to collect it, a little girl opens the door and says, "My daddy's not at home right now. He tells you to go f*** it yourself." Come on, Martin, I can do it. I can do it. It'll be seamless.
John's been sleeping with a horse's head on his pillow for the last 10 years, Buglers, just to get himself into character.
It doesn't help that Berlusconi doesn't seem to have any real interest in solving the problem. He pushed some austerity measures through, supposedly because the European Bank forced him to, but I think it's more likely that the European Bank were forced to hire a 17-year-old girl in a miniskirt to convince him that it was worth doing instead. In fact, such is the anger at Berlusconi in Italy at the moment that I wouldn't be surprised if there is a meat hook somewhere in Rome with Berlusconi's name on it. I certainly wouldn't take any leisurely strolls past any butcher shops if I was him.
He must have done that as a role play, to be fair.
And as you mentioned, part of the anger stems from more revelations of behaviour so seedy you could sprinkle it onto soil and grow a forest of douchery from it. And it all, the amazing thing is, these wiretapped conversations all come from a blackmail trial in which Berlusconi is, wait for it, the victim. I know. It doesn't sound grammatically correct, that, does it? But believe me, I've checked it out and apparently it's accurate. I wouldn't be surprised if he just automatically walked into the defendant's dock in court anyway before being awkwardly ushered out, saying, well, I'm not on trial? Oh, shit, yeah, I forgot. Force of habit, I'm afraid. I'm a sorry!
Well, he is currently involved in or facing 4 different trials involving a range of offences, including abuse of office, business malpractice, bribery and underage sex. Now, you might think that's pretty much a full house, but as Berlusconi has repeatedly shown, there is plenty of room in his house. He could always squeeze in much more than you would think looking at the floor plan. And, you know, if there's one man who could be accused of using taxpayers' money and state-owned aircraft to fly prostitutes around from various places in the world to his penis and get away with it electorally, Berlusconi is that man, John.
Yes, not many
politicians have that. He was described in the Daily Telegraph this week as, quotes, scandal prone, which was rather neat way of putting it. I believe Ratko Mladic's lawyers used the same term in The Hague the other day. I guess it's neater than underage sex prone or outright criminal. But anyway, I guess in the same way that Roger Federer is hitting a tennis ball prone.
The problem is that the evidence in this blackmail trial, which is now part of the public record, features some pretty low-grade behaviour from the Italian scallion himself. I say scallion, Andy, because as a man he's undeniably flavourful, but too much of him leaves a rather unpleasant aftertaste.
Now, Andy does dress up like a spring onion every Thursday as well, in another one of his role plays. Dressed up as Mussolini in a spring onion costume hanging from a meat hook. Anyway.
These tapes show a man with a lifestyle so horn-based that even Caligula would have dusted himself off and said, OK, ladies, that was fun, but seriously, I really need to get some work done now.
It's a bit of a risk, don't you think, John, for Italy in these straitened economic times to have a Prime Minister who considers a double-dip recession to be scaling back from 8 hookers a night to 2?
The calls reveal the extent to which parties involving dozens of young models and escort girls were arranged for Berlusconi by his middleman, Giampaolo Tarantini, a pimp and convicted cocaine dealer. He's the man who's been accused of blackmailing Berlusconi in exchange for his silence over the alleged prostitution ring. And do we actually, technically, do we need to keep saying alleged, Andy? I mean, Is it not basically legally safe now just to call it a prostitution ring? I don't know how much doubt is really involved here anymore. Anyway, the point is, in one conversation, as you mentioned, Berlusconi bragged that he had sex with 8 women in one night. He said, last night I had a queue outside my door. There were 11 of them. I only managed to do 8 of them. I couldn't manage any more. You can't get round to all of them. And that has to be bullshit. He sounds like a 12-year-old boy coming back from summer camp saying to his friends, yeah, of course I had sex. When I was at camp, I had sex with 1 million gajillion girls, all of whom were models from Canada who I'm still in regular contact with, but who you cannot find on the internet.
Well, I guess unless it was, you know, taken out of context and we said he said that he had 11 of them, but he only managed to do 8 of them. Maybe it was Sudoku puzzles. I mean, we don't know necessarily.
That's true. That's true. He was talking in Italian, and no one really speaks that language.
No, not anymore. They haven't for 2,000 years properly, anyway.
So, because of these tapped phone calls, Berlusconi is also now accused of giving his pimp a diplomatic visa to join him on a trip to China. Tarantini apparently phoned up a colleague to ask how he could set up a night's entertainment for Berlusconi during the visit, saying, I want someone on the inside who can organise an evening, because he said he'll get fed up with the official formal things there. And to be fair, Andy, state visits do look boring. Now, I'm sure that whenever the Queen goes away, she has a bunch of male strippers back in her hotel room so she can just blow off some steam after seeing yet another group of schoolchildren in traditional dress squawk their way through a national folk song. That was so boring! Giovanni, oil yourself up and show Lizzie what the good Lord gave you! I'm going to bounce this 50-pence piece with my face on it off your buttocks!
Are you listening, Mr. Scorsese? Are you listening?
Come on, I can do a kind of queen as well. If you needed a queen,
you just don't want to be
kind of 1920s Brooklyn.
You don't want to be a victim of your own versatility, John. I think you should either focus on the Queen or the Italian.
Okay.
An added complication is that as further details have emerged of Berlusconi's beyond Caligulan lifestyle, he is imposing a multi-billion euro austerity package on his people, which must be slightly hard to take from a man who looks like he would happily slap $1 million bill on a stripper's arse and tell her to go buy herself something nice.
But that's the point, Andy. Like you said, he refers to himself as Prime Minister in his spare time, so it's amazing he's even got time to try and do this. Because presumably he would put on his tax form that his real job was Duke of Banging. I'm sure that everyone's thinking, well, that must be it.
That was the title of your debut Edinburgh show, wasn't it, Tom?
It was, and it was misunderstood. people thought there was a second meaning there, and there really wasn't. You might be thinking, well, that must be it. You can't get any worse than claiming that you're Prime Minister in your spare time. And now, I would say to that, do you not know who you're dealing with here? This is Silvio fucking Berlusconi. Fucking is literally his middle name. He had it changed by deed poll. And the truth is, it does get worse. On the 13th of July, he erupted in anger during a phone call saying, they can say about me that I screw. It's the only thing they can say about me. Is that clear? They can put listening devices where they like, and the fact that this was being taped proved that was true. They can tap my telephone calls, said Silvio, again, misunderstanding just how ironic that was about to become. I don't give a f***. In a few months, I'm getting out to mind my own f***ing business from somewhere else, and so I'm leaving this shitty country of which I'm sickened. Ouch.
Vote for me.
Shitty country. Oh, dear. Although, to be fair to him, since Berlusconi came to power 10 years ago, Italy is a lot shittier than it once was. And his response to this particular revelation was to argue, it's the kind of thing you say late at night when you are relaxed. Relaxed? You mean wasted, right, Silvio? You definitely mean wasted. It's all the more incredible that he said shitty country shortly after acknowledging that he knew his phone calls were being taped. And all of this leads us to the crowning moment from the tapes, the absolute apex of Berlusconi's achievement, where he calls German Chancellor Angela Merkel an unfuckable lard arse. Now, that would be bad enough. It is bad enough. Let's give him credit where it's due. It's definitely technically bad enough, but not for the fact that the unfuckable lard arse in question is standing between his country and complete bankruptcy. Italy's debts are more than Spain, Portugal, Ireland and Greece combined. They need Germany's help more than ever before. And he just called the woman in charge of making that critical decision an unfuckable lard arse. Andy, I think this might be Berlusconi's greatest moment. His work in Italy is technically now done.
Well, to be fair, you know, there have been worse things said about German leaders through history. Yeah.
True. But there are two more incredible details surrounding this. One, the Corriere della Sera, one of the newspapers that's printed the transcripts, cautioned its readers that it's omitted the heavier or more vulgar passages, as well as detailed sexual descriptions that were picked up in phone calls. So this, Andy, is the censored stuff. I have to hear it all. Are they going to sell the uncut version? Because if they do, that would make a fortune. That alone might get Italy out of financial trouble.
What about the film versions?
Exactly. Huge. And Berlusconi's approval rating is now at an all-time low of 24%. But still, you think that's low. Then you think, hold on, that's high. Who are these people? That's a quarter of Italian people watching a man who's been on trial for tax evasion, bribery and soliciting underage prostitutes and saying, I think he's doing a great job. What does he have to do for these people to turn on him?
Angela Merkel, could she offer him a bailout on the condition that he slept with her? Just to put his comments to the test.
Yeah.
Well, he definitely has no leverage whatsoever. So, you know, were she to want to do that, so that would be demeaning herself. To a very large extent. It must be very difficult for her to like turn up to G8 meetings now without looking at him and the idiots around him thinking, you are a f***ing moron.
But just knowing that all the other delegates are thinking, well, you know, did he have a point? I mean, yeah, what does un-f***able mean anyway, John? Does he mean that, you know, that he realised that she was off limits, that she was a serious political partner?
Well, that is some,
and it would have been
spinning,
completely inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. Lardass, of course, is an ancient Roman compliment for someone who is difficult to budge from a position of conviction.
Okay.
But it's just these things get lost in translation, John.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty much a chat-up line. That's basically what I'm saying. So, Standard & Poor's has downgraded Italy's credit rating officially from low-budget scooter to fully clapped-out moped, and it is basically going to join Greece in being sold off for scrap, probably by the end of next year. And the British Museum is loitering with intent, hoping to pick up some new trinkets. Even the Pope, John, has waded in on this one. The Pope, whose own franchise has not always been quite the vigorous guardian of ethical probity that it might like to have been, with hindsight. The Pope has said that Italy needs an ethical renewal. Mm-hmm. Now, I would say Italian politics does not merely need ethical renewal. It needs to be ethically taken back to the library with an apology, an explanation as to why it's 700 years overdue, and a blank cheque to pay off what presumably is an absolute humdinger of a fine. And on a recent visit to Germany, the Pope, on his old stamping ground, or at least his old goose-stepping ground at least, said, the Church is a net of the Lord that pulls in good fish and bad fish. Mm-hmm. In explaining some of the things that have gone a little wrong in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. The Church is a net of the law that pulls in good fish and bad fish. Now, that's a fair point. But it must be remembered that most decent fishermen would probably then throw the bad fish back into the sea, not to cover up their existence for decades while attempting to pass them off as a perfectly tasty salmon mousse.
Give me a P! Give me an A! Give me an L! Wait, if you're going to say Palestine, you are not getting any more letters. That is not a recognisable word in the UN dictionary. Andy, the long journey on the roundabout to peace in the Middle East took another turn this week when cheeky little Palestine unexpectedly announced that they were going to ask the UN to recognise them as an official state. And they would need to get 9 out of 15 council members to vote for them, with no vetoes from any of the permanent members. And the problem is that on this issue, America has a very twitchy veto finger. It's not that they want to veto a Palestinian state, and it's just their finger. Their finger just loves vetoing Palestinians. They have a very compassionate heart and a very conservative finger. Naughty finger. I think everyone agrees that a two-state solution is the only realistic answer here. What's that finger? Ow! Ow finger! Don't poke me in the eye finger! Naughty finger! Don't you press that veto! Don't you do it! Ah! Veto! Ah! Ah, veto! Veto! Ah!
A Palestine has put in a bid to be a full member of the UN with all the benefits that entails, which are basically a free sports hold-all, a set of six beer mats with Ban Ki-moon face on, and a 20% discount in Nando's anywhere in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. So we
That's
can't,
not nothing.
You can see why they're getting so agitated about it. They, Palestine thinks they should be full members. Israel, any guesses, disagrees with that. And
oh, okay.
America have put the... Okay, into equivocation. Now, according to one Palestinian academic, one of the problems involved in the current bumpy road towards peace is Tony Blair, the self-proclaimed lifelong peace fan who's been involved in the negotiations in his role as part of the quartet, whatever the f*** that is. And he apparently is not universally popular. And this Palestinian academic said the Palestinian leadership not only distrust him, they disrespect him. His accounts of supposed achievements on behalf of the Palestinian economy are deeply resented as overblown and self-promoting. Zing! That is a one-star review, John. That is a one-star... I mean... We in Britain would find it very hard to find that Blair was being overblown and self-promoting. That's just not it's not the kind of guy he was.
That's not the guy we knew and loved.
No, he just loved democracy. That's all.
Yeah.
That was literally all.
He's a fan of peace in the way that someone would claim they were a fan of Bon Jovi without being able to name who the lead singer was. If this Palestinian bid for statehood fails, Andy, and by if I mean when this fails, because America may or may not veto it, and, you know, when I say may, I mean will veto it, possibly, and by possibly I mean definitely. When this bid fails because America will definitely veto it, Mahmoud Abbas could then, his other option, he could then ask for a vote of the General Assembly for enhanced observer status, where no veto is possible, which would put them on par with the Vatican. They would become as much of a state as the Vatican, and all they would need then is a gigantic reserve of money, and the Swiss will just turn up out of nowhere to guard them. But the best tactic the Palestinians came up with was that they turned up at the UN with their own chair. They'd made a very comfortable-looking blue chair with the UN symbol on the back and the word Palestine written across it, almost as if they wanted to make it as simple a transition for the UN as possible. Look, we've even brought our own chair and snacks as well. You won't even know that we're here. We'll be invisible, quiet as a mouse. We would just like to table this one motion, this one little motion about Israel's illegal occupation of Palestine, and then you won't hear another peep out of us. Not a peep. And that they should also agree to return to the 1967 borders. But not a squeak. That was our very last squeak. We're not here.
Also, the UN, Ahmadinejad's disappointing performance from him, John. Just crapped out the same old shit at the UN as every year, basically, prompting another... predictable walkout. And yeah. I just think it's such a shame that he always gets walkouts. I think it would be really interesting just to see the look on his face if the delegates begun by nodding their heads, then after a couple of minutes started applauding at the end of his sentences. And then just
really
broke into a standing ovation halfway through a suggestion that Israel was not on his Christmas card list. Just to see how much it threw him off his delivery. There is no way he would be psychologically prepared for that. Absolutely no way.
It is amazing just that, like, the tone of these walkouts now. As soon as he starts denying the Holocaust took place, you can see delegates go, oh well, here we go. or he should... next year, he should really leave it right for the end. Because I'm sure there are people that have got early dinner reservations that are just banking on him almost opening with denying the Holocaust. You can't want to see them calling their wives, go, look, I don't know, I think we're going to be late. I think he's not done it yet.
Economics news now. Are you an investor worried about your portfolio in these times of economic uncertainty? Do you tend to panic at the first sign of trouble and sell anything you can see, touch, think about or steal? Then grow some f***ing balls. The whole of the global economy is being once again humped to the precipice of catastrophe by the financial markets, where it does seem, John, that we have put the entire economic stability of the Western world in the hands of some easily startled lunatics predicated on the age-old philosophy, I'll probably be fine. And things are looking bad, John. I mean, what's the reaction in America to... I mean, are people fussed about total economic meltdown of the entire Western world?
Well, it's hard to say, because the American economy itself is not in good shape. It's currently calling for a priest and...
asking him if he's got any good investment tips. What I'm saying is it's not dead, it's just desperate.
But it does seem to me, John, that the governments in the West have basically been overindulgent parents to their rogue financial children, the financial markets, have now turned up back at home with a dubious spouse and a drinking problem and said, you know how you said you'd always be there for me, Mummy? Well, be a dear and clear my gambling debts for me. A few trillions should get the off my back. Now, where's my hammock? Bring me a caviar enchilada or I'll shit on your patio. Take my shoes off. Clean my f***ing shoes. I don't like them. Buy me some new shoes. I'm allergic to nitrogen. Get out of the air of this house or I'll scream. Milk two sugars. F***ing pronto. Snap to it, bitch. Don't mind me. I'm pissing on your television. Oh, no, it's caught fire. What have you done with my doggy? Well, I want him here and I want him now. Dig him up and give him CPR or I'll bury you and see how you like it. Stop looking at me. You don't own me. Give me an axe. I want to smash up your car. You're fired. Where's my inheritance? Clean the floor. I can't walk on that. Why don't you love me anymore? F*** you. F*** you. F*** you.
Things definitely don't look good. The head of the World Bank has warned that the world is in an economic danger zone, like the danger zone that Tom Cruise flew through in Top Gun. We just need to put on our mirrored sunglasses and oil up our volleyball-ready pecs and get out there. I feel the need, Andy, the need for substantial economic recovery.
Oh, it's a problem, John. You know, this. You know, basically, for the last few months, they've been saying it's all going to be fine. Basically, we've been playing the goose in that particular analogy. And now it's just patently obvious things aren't going to end well. Christine Lagarde, the recently appointed IMF chief, and well in the running for the 2011 title of IMF boss, least likely to be accused of splinter-bootling a hotel chambermaid. She said the world was entering a dangerous place. As you said, Robert Zoellick said it was in a danger zone. And it is slightly concerning that even those at the very top of the economic game, even they see the current state of the economy as analogous to the trailer for a shit scary horror film. That is not a financial world I'm comfortable with, John.
The International Monetary Fund has warned that the global financial system is now more vulnerable than at any time since the 2008 financial crisis. And it turns out that basically everyone in Europe is now in trouble. Economic instability is contagious and Greece has been sneezing on everyone. Even Germany, who have less unemployment now than they did in 2008 and who have somehow been experiencing quite strong growth over the last few years, even Germany are now at risk due to their exposure to Greek banks and their being the largest contributor to the EU emergency bailout fund. It must be so incredibly annoying for Germany to have to take what amounts to the entire continent on their fiscal shoulders, especially when one of the members of that continent has been calling their leader an unfuckable lardass. I just hope all of this isn't making them too angry, Andy, because they are not nice when they are angry. Am I right, Andy? Am I right about that?
Well, it was ages ago, John. It was ages ago. I'm sure. I'm quite confident they've learned their lesson. Mm-hmm. I'm relatively optimistic. But yeah. So as you said, the IMF has said that the financial system is more vulnerable than at any time for the last 3 years, and it does appear the lessons of 2008 have not so much been not learnt as not read. Not even opened when the envelope dropped through the door before being recycled, whilst the next 3 years of global economics have been based on a takeaway pizza menu instead. Depressing times, John. The good ship HMS Unbridled Capitalism set off on its unsinkable voyage across the ocean of economics with a hull made of sugar on the grounds that it might not dissolve, and even if it does, by that time we'll have so much money we'll just buy our way off the bottom of the ocean, drowned or undrowned. Your emails now. This one comes from Michael, spelt without an E, so it might be pronounced differently, in the Czech Republic. On the subject, no success for Smurfs in the Czech Republic.
What now?
Well, dear John, Andy and Chris, in descending order of probability of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad having his private photo album of you, much like Gaddafi had of Mrs. Rice.
I would be honoured.
I believe it's Miss Rice. Which, anyway, focus, everyone. I have a quick Smurfs update for John, says Michal, or Michael. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in a tram in Prague when a mother with a daughter got on. The daughter, 8 years old, according to my best estimate, mumbled something, after which her mother responded loudly and clearly, "No, darling, you know I like going to movies with you, and I'll go to any movie with you, but not the Smurfs. You're too old for that bullshit." 5 minutes of persuading followed, when sadly the daughter gave up. But don't worry, John. I'm sure at least at the Bollywood classic The Love Guru that you were so viciously tricked to co-star in, enjoyed a real success here in the Czech Republic. That is, no one ever really heard of it.
Hey! Hey, McCall!
Keep on bugling,
bullshit.
He says.
That is bullshit. That is complete bullshit. $450 million, all right? That little girl. We didn't need her. And you can put that on the poster for Smurfs too.
That's another one to be added to your list of beefs, John. An 8-year-old Czech girl on a bus. So thanks to all of those of you who sent in pictures of the massive wall wang in Reykjavik. Yeah. Possibly one of the finest graffitied wangs. An astonishingly long wang. Mm-hmm. Must have looked a good 50 yards. And, you know, that's probably bigger than all the wangs in Iceland combined. Particularly after the economic crash. Thanks. I don't know, it might be time to ask you to scale back on sending us pictures of penises, but I don't know.
Well, you know? Andy, it's very charming that you seem to think you're in control of that. I think the very fact that you ask that is likely to increase the rate at which they're being sent. When you open Pandora's box, Andy, you cannot then ask for it to be shut.
I think I have a work email address here that picks up these emails that, if closely inspected, would lead to my arrest.
Well, luckily, News International got so many other arrests happening at the moment, so I think we'll be OK. Or not.
Sport now, and, well, a big story coming out from Turkey and Turkish football, where Fenerbahce, one of the big clubs in Turkish football, had a game where men were barred due to crowd trouble at previous matches, and they had a women and
the
children
Turks really
only.
They know their way around crowd trouble as well,
They do. I mean, they do have something of a reputation for jaunty behaviour, ranging from sacrificing animals on the pitch before matches to allegedly committing genocide against Armenia in the early 20th century. So the Turkish FA came up with a radical solution to these behavioural issues. No blokes. And in fact, they initially told Fenerbahce to play behind closed doors in an empty stadium, then refined it so that the stadium was empty of men, which many people in football consider to be basically the same thing. But 40,000 women and children turned up, and a one-all draw was played out in Fenerbahce's next match to enthusiasm and excitement as opposed to vitriol and racism. So
I really think, though, Andy, that if those women of Fenerbahce had had any sense of humour, they would have had a colossal riot. It would have been so funny. Look, about 88 minutes, game's nearly over, just an enormous fight. Also, I guess the key question is, how many men were dressed up as women with comically high-pitched voices? Because I bet it was like a Monty Python sketch inside that stadium. Oh, come on, Fenerbahce, kill him! Kill him! I'm a lady!
Male football fans the world over do have a well-earned reputation for behaving like Neanderthals whose parents didn't love them. And it's one of the most glorious sights in all sport, John, to see a highly skilled athlete at the very peak of his powers score an incredible goal and then trot past a row of 25-stone medical statistics in waiting, all summoning the most vigorous physical manoeuvre in their armoury and risking arterial meltdown by flicking wanker signs at him as he runs past. So it's a beautiful picture of what humanity is all about.
Yep.
But I don't know, it must have been fascinating to see what it was like to see 40,000 people simultaneously chanting recipes for sponge cake. Also, the Rugby World Cup's been going on. I imagine there's been pretty much blanket coverage of that in America.
Oh, it's
with
just
the,
huge.
The Eagles doing their best for...
Yes, if that's what they're called, yeah.
England country, yep.
Mm-hmm. Touchdown!
England, so far... have disgraced the sport, as they tend to do. Watching England play rugby, it's like watching a rhino trying to shit a filing cabinet. Deeply depressing. And it's been overshadowed by allegations of dwarf tossing in a night out involving England players. They're completely untrue, but that's not the point. The important thing is that allegations have been made without any grounding. And that really reflects badly on English rugby. Particularly the fact that if they were throwing and catching dwarves, then that should be encouraged. Anything that encourages England to practice throwing and catching anything, that's got to be a good thing for the rugby team. So England basically have the same attitude to entertainment in rugby as the Taliban had to scantily clad girl bands. But the exciting news, if ex-producer Tom is listening down in Australia, is that I had a dream. And that dream was that Scotland, the nation that produced ex-producer Tom, won the Rugby World Cup final, beating the mighty New Zealand All Blacks in the final. Now, I mean,
that's
this is
not going to happen.
No, I mean, that is even less likely than Martin Luther King's dream fully coming true. But and also a mitigating factor in that was that the World Cup final was being held in my old college library and I was playing for New Zealand. Alongside the 1980s TV magician Paul Daniels. But I don't know what can be read into that.
That's a weird dream, Andy.
That is a weird dream.
That's a very strange dream.
It's not quite as strange as you having that dream about us going to see England footballer Les Ferdinand doing a stand-up gig.
Not just a stand-up gig, Andy, a stand-up gig in Wembley Stadium. Front row seats. I can't remember if we've talked about this before. What happened? I had this dream. Andy and I were sitting in the front row centre. Great tickets. And then Les Ferdinand walked out to do stand-up, and Andy turned to me and said, "This guy's absolutely amazing." And then he pressed a button in his suit pocket, and a sparkly green bow tie that he was wearing suddenly started spinning round and round. And that was it. The crowd went crazy. And Andy looked at me and said, "See, the guy's hilarious." Weird dream.
I stand by that. I stand by that dream. Thing that I didn't actually say, but had I said it, I'd have meant it. So that's it for this week's Bugle, and I'm afraid we've now got another 2 weeks off, because John's got more shit to do, and more on that in 3 weeks' time. So I don't know what we're going to put out next for the next 2 weeks. Chris, any ideas?
No. I've got no ideas.
Oh, Don't spoil it. It's going to be all the more exciting to see what comes out.
There we go. So sorry about it. It's been a bit disrupted, the Bugle, of late, but we'll be back mid-October, and it's going to be pure dynamite from then until the end of the year. Absolutely literal dynamite. Goodbye, Buglers.
Farewell!